Well, this morning you can just sit back and relax. I'm going to give you some history. I plan to preach on the book of Hebrews in time to come. And so I thought I'd get two birds with one stone. New Year's message and an introduction to the book of Hebrews. And so you can just sit back and enjoy it. Now, I wonder, have you ever thought what New Year's would have been like in Jesus' day, or after his day, say for the next 40, 50 years? What was it like? Now, they didn't have New Year's Day when we have New Year's Day. They actually had two New Year's Day. There was a civil one and a religious one. But every year they would have looked ahead and said, wondered what it would be like now. Now, what do you think it was like back then? They're driving horse and buggy, and everything was just kind of laid back and peaceful and nice. Really quite different from our day, because there was just not the same kind of tensions we have with COVID and all this kind of stuff. Well, you think about their New Year's Day in light of the message today. So remember, I'm giving you introductory material to the book of Hebrews. By the way, would you have some water handy? So let me say this at the outset of this series, that I hold to the majority text of the New Testament. Almost, if not all, modern translations use what is called the eclectic text. And the main reason I do not use those texts is because if the oldest manuscripts are best, which almost all, if not all, new translations say are the best, then for the majority of the church age, we didn't have the best text. I just find that unacceptable. So I hold to the view that the Lord divinely protected the texts of the scriptures. And second, the Lord divinely protected the words that belong in scripture. Now, one of the most difficult points in interpreting the letters of the New Testament that the writer is that the writer is writing for a reason or for various reasons. And the reader knows what he's talking about. The writer knows what he's talking about, but you and I don't necessarily know what he's talking about. And so in order to interpret, you have to try to glean some of this out of the book. So we're interpreting some 2,000 years after the book was written. And not having some or most of the information, one must try to reconstruct what was it like back then. If you were reading a letter I wrote, and it went like this: We've had good weather for the last 2 months. We did have a storm, but it wasn't bad. Hunting wasn't good this fall, and the moose season's almost over. Oh, about your question, I always try to make points around the bar, and as many as I possibly can. If you can make a prime, you pretty well have it made. Sometimes when you are behind, all you can do is sit back and wait and hope for a chance to shoot. In the meantime, you try to make as many points in your inner table as possible. The big question is always to blot or not to blot. Good luck. Oh, I would like to know how you made out with your trip to Alaska. Send me some pictures, and then you sign off. How many of you would know what the person's question was?
It's a game.
It's a game. It's backgammon. It's the backgammon game. Now, you see, if you were going to interpret my letter, you would have to find out what I'm talking about. That's how many of the epistles are. That's how Hebrews is. Now, it's not that I go to a bar, you see. I don't go to a bar. Although I try to make points around the bar, you see, this is a game. And here is the rule of interpretation in the Bible. Well, it's the rule of interpretation everywhere. You have only interpreted right when you have in your mind what the writer had in his mind when he wrote. Then to interpret this letter, one has to determine why two chapters are given to dealing with angels. He just decided to write about angels? No. There's a good reason why he wrote about angels. And then, why is so much time given to Judaism in the book of Hebrews? So we ask our first question, and you can just relax a little later on. You'll get the connection to New Year's a little better. Who was the author? Who can tell me? Who wrote this book? Somebody? Who wrote this book?
We don't know.
Charles Ryrie of the Ryrie Reference Bible says, many suggestions have been made for the author of this anonymous book. Paul, Barnabas, Apollos, Silas, Aquila, Priscilla, Clement of Rome. He also says that it was not likely Paul because of chapter 2, verse 3. This writer appeals to eyewitnesses, and Paul frequently appeals to his own authorities. Well, all of this is interpretation. So I don't think you can speculate with any value to interpreting this book on who the author is. One of the early church fathers called Origen said that we just simply don't know. That's the answer. We don't know. He wrote from, he lived from 184 to 253 years after Christ. Now I have to say that when I read this letter, to me it sounds a lot like the Apostle Paul. Listen to chapter 10, verses 32 through 34. I'll just read it for you. But recall the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your own goods, knowing that you have a better and an enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Some of these passages just sound like Paul to me. John Gill says, it has been ascribed to different persons, as to Barnabas, to Apollos, to Luke the evangelist, and to Clement of Rome, but without any just reason. Clement of Alexandria, a very ancient writer, asserts it to be the Apostle Paul's, and his name stands in the title of it. In all R. Stephen's exemplars, and in all Beza's copies, excepting one, and so it does in the Vulgate Latin and Arabic versions, and that it is his, that is, it's Paul's writings. And then they compare passages and see how it sounds and so on. So who wrote the book of Hebrews? Well, we simply don't know. With regard to the question as to whom this letter was written, I think we can safely say that it was written to, what would you say? What kind of people? It's most likely written to Jewish people. It says to the Hebrews, but we don't know if the title is original or not. But the book itself lends itself to the idea that it was Jewish people. Ryrie says, where did they live? Palestine or Italy? Have been the answers most often given. The preference seems to be Italy, for these readers were not poor, as the saints in Palestine were, and then he gives references. The verse that gives the most help here, as little as it is Hebrews chapter 13, verse 24, and it says, greet all those who rule over you, and all the saints, those from Italy, greet you. So I'd like to have Sunday school class right now. What do you think? Ellicott says of the words, they of Italy salute you. Unfortunately, these words admit of two possible interpretations. Either the author is himself in Italy and sends to the Hebrew Christians whom he addresses the salutations of an Italian church, or writing to Italy, he transmits the message which those of Italy who are now with him send to their fellow Christians at home. He then questions the possibility if the letter is being sent to Israel or being sent to Italy, one of the two. I think there's a third possibility. If you want to turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 18. Acts chapter 18, verses 1 and 2. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome, and he came to them. So there came a time when all the Jews had to leave Italy. Our question is, when did this happen? And the answer is, it took place in 49 A.D., Now, I don't know where these Jews went, but it could be to any place where they had friends or that they knew about. By the way, let me just slip in here. When did Christopher Columbus sail the ocean blue? 1492, and he set out from Italy because all the Jews at that time were expelled from Italy again. And he himself may have been a Jew. Well, Emperor Claudius, that we read about in Acts, died in AD 54, and after this, the Jews would have been able to begin to return. So let us say that these Jews were expelled from Rome. Let's say you had to all leave Vanderhoof. Some of you would go there, you have friends, some would go there, and these people could have gone any place. So let's just say, for example, that they were at Alexandria, and the writer is writing from Antioch, and he says, "They of Italy send their greetings." This would mean that there were Italian Jews at Antioch, and they were sending greetings to Italian Jews in Alexandria. So we just simply don't know where it was written from or who it was written to. Wherever they have settled, it seems to me they may have been short of leadership and they are discouraged. You ever get discouraged? Yeah. And more, they are thinking of leaving the Lord. The movement of the church is still quite small and scattered, and the Messiah is not doing anything, and he's not doing a thing to make things better. They became Christians. They said the Lord's coming soon. It's getting worse and worse, and nothing's happening. Life, for the most part, is very difficult. They have paid a huge price already, and when they look at their Jewish people who have their traditional synagogue and their movement is kept solid by their traditions, they are beginning to think of going back. I'm going back. And so life for them was just so difficult that they were getting discouraged. It is indicated in the letter that these Hebrew Christians had suffered persecution in the past, and this had happened after they became Christians, chapter 10, verse 32 through 34. In Hebrews 12:4, we learn that they had not endured persecutions to the shedding of blood yet. We haven't either. All our life, not mom and dad here, but for us, we've had it good. All our life. Our Mennonites have never had it this good or this long in any country before. I would guess that these are Italian Jews who have been driven out of Spain, have settled somewhere else, and one would think where they lived, things began to build up. It got more and more uncomfortable. Talk began to happen, and they were talking about driving out the Jews, and they're getting more and more uncomfortable. And finally, Claudius says, "Out, they're done here," and they all have to go. They didn't have to go because they were Christians. They had to go because they were Jews. So it seems to me that the time they endured persecution went on for some time before they were driven out of Italy, as one would hardly think that this would happen overnight. We have seen in our time how things progress over a short time. So as to the date of this letter, I think it is hardly possible that it could have been after AD 70. Somebody tell me the main event in AD 70. Destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And in the book, from the tenses of the verbs used, it sounds to me like the temple is still being used at this time. Further, I think that it would have been written before AD 67. This is when the first Jewish war took place with Rome. This war lasted from 67 to 73. This war came to an end when Masada fell. Tell me, how many of you know about Masada? Well, that's worth learning. Masada. The Jewish saying today, Masada shall never fall again. If the book had been written after the Jewish war began, I think it would have affected how this letter was written. By the way, when I used to read books and so on, what I skipped was the introduction. You guys do this? in order to interpret this book, you have to know the introduction. You can't interpret some things unless you understand some of these. Now, from all this, I would conclude that the letter would be written somewhere between AD 49 and 67. So either the Roman ruler Claudius or Nero were in power at the time this letter was written. Now, does it make a difference who's in power in Canada, Harper or Trudeau? Yeah, that's how it was back then as well. With regard to the occasion and purpose of the writing of this letter, the Zondervan Encyclopedia says, "The people to whom the letter was sent were in danger of losing their initial enthusiasm. When first they became Christians, their exhilaration was such that they rejoiced amid persecution, endured plunder and outrage without complaint, and were unstinting in their service of fellow believers, especially those who were imprisoned. With the passage of years, their earlier zest waned. The parousia, that's the return of Christ, which they had ardently expected, seemed as distant as ever." That's today. We look around. The majority of Christians don't. It just doesn't look like it's very near. So they had earnestly expected it, but it's waning away, and seemed as distant as ever. The Jewish establishment and the fellowship of the synagogue, which they had given up for Christianity, continued to flourish and to offer the protection of religion, whose practice was licensed by the Roman state. Their original impetus slackened off. They were tempted to look backward instead of forward. Hence the urgency with which the author exhorts them, using a number of metaphors, not to drift downstream, but to row hard against the current, not to flag in the race, but to persevere in the faith. I ask you, do we need that? Let me ask you, how many of you have seen someone, they became a Christian, oh, they were so excited, they were just on the go, they're talking to everybody, and then slowly they began to drift. How many have seen this? It's our ever-present danger. I don't know where you are this morning. Which way are you going? Now, though one cannot learn much to help in interpreting the letter from who the writer was or where the recipients lived, one can get more help from the political climate in which these Christians lived. We'll start a long way back and come up to the time the letter was written. Around 635 years before Jesus was born, that's where we'll start, and at this time Nebuchadnezzar took Daniel and his friends captive to Babylon. Later in life, Daniel prophesied about four world powers. By the way, you might check out on the internet, how many of you have seen the beast set up at the UN? Yeah, okay, so you can read Daniel, and you can look at the beast, and you can say, we are in the last days. Well, Babylon ruled from 626 to 539 BC. Yeah, by the way, all this time, the Jews said Messiah is coming. Every 100 years, 50 years, Messiah is coming. Never came. And when they had all but given up, he came. And so, while it was, then one power came after another. Babylon rose, ruled the world. And then the next power, the Medes and the Persians took over. And then Greece took over. And who came next? Rome. Rome came in about 63 years before Christ. While it reached its zenith, each power, while it reached its zenith, another power was already coming up. And so, while it reached its zenith, already another kingdom had been forming, and that was Rome. And it began to rule in 63 BC and ruled almost 500 years. We still have a lot of Rome in our present governmental systems. Let me give a brief account of life in Israel from when Rome began to rule until Christ came, from a section in a book called A History of the Jews, written by Abram Leon Sacher. And I'll reduce much of it and put it into some of it into my own words. Rome has just begun to rule the world. This is 63 years before Christ came. Herod's father, Antipater, who was an Idumean, was a successful politician. When Pompey died, Antipater quickly turned to Caesar. Antipater became a Roman citizen and ruled over Israel. By the way, we're in the times of the Gentiles by this time. His career was cut short when he was given a cup of poison when he was feasting at a banquet. And it was then that his son Herod, the one that ruled when Christ came, took over. So this is the Herod that was that killed all the babies when Christ was born. So 39 years before Christ, he came to Israel. Israel fought, but they were no match, and Rome took over Israel. In the years of Roman rule before Christ, politically, things were unstable. Do you think they are unstable now? Yeah. Not much more so than back then. The land changed hands four times, and it affected Israel disastrously. The Maccabees. Now, if you read the old German Bibles, you will have the Aufschriften. Anybody know about those? Okay. They have the books of the Maccabees in those. The Maccabees, who were Jews, came on the stage and resisted Rome. Many Jews were slaughtered. Then Jerusalem was besieged, and there was even more slaughter of Jews. Do you think COVID is rough? It's nothing compared to some of what history has gone through with other people. So you can see that politically, it was a very unstable time. Let me quote from the book. The Roman fury was so great that Herod himself, you know Herod, you could hardly make things too bad for him, that he himself protested. He said, here's what this cruel man said. Would the Romans deprive the city of all its inhabitants and possessions and leave me a kingdom in the wilderness? Are they going to kill everybody? Well, he did become king when the Romans were satisfied with their killing. Let me just say that the Jews, by the way, this is just before Christ came. That's what it was like in the world. So let me say in all of this, though, that the Jews themselves were not guiltless in some of the disaster that took place. Well, Herod himself was hard on the Jews. And if that was not enough, in 31 BC, they had an earthquake that shook the land and killed thousands of the inhabitants and destroyed a lot of valuable property. Josephus estimates that 10,000 Jews were killed just from stuff falling off in their houses in the top of it. Well, Herod was a strong and able ruler. And at this time, there were also many bandits in Israel. You see, there was instability. Then when Herod took over, he squelched all that. And once more, the Israelis could farm a little bit in peace, I guess. They had been through very tumultuous times. The book says this of Herod. By all the laws of compensation, Herod should have been one of the best loved rulers in history. It was his fate to be the most despised. He was popular among the Gentiles of Galilee and Samaria and among the Jews of the dispersion, whom he invariably befriended. But his subjects in Judea hated him. They hated his despotism, though it was no more severe than the Hasmonean predecessors and much more necessary after decades of dynastic bickering. All kinds of trouble. But by the time Jesus came on the scene, things had changed again. Let me quote once more. But even more important, in awakening the antipathies of the Jews toward him was Herod's unfortunate temperament. Few men in history have stained their hands with so much blood of dearest kin, close relatives. Towards the end of his life, Herod executed mercilessly, almost wantonly, wife, children, relatives, friends, all who opposed him, until Augustus exclaimed, "Better to be Herod's swine than his son." You think it's bad, no? It is into this politically charged time that Jesus Christ was born. You know that not long after Jesus was born, Herod killed all the boy babies. Can you picture this? Around Bethlehem, all the little boys, everybody just dies. So this is the political scene at the time of Christ's birth. Jews were longing for the Messiah. Today with COVID, our attention is turning more and more to the return of Christ. In those days, there was more and more talk of the coming of the Messiah. And when Jesus came, the Jews did not recognize him as the Messiah. And from this time, it would be another 30 years before he even began his ministry. Now Herod knew that when he died, nobody would mourn his death. So just before he died, he took a lot of the very important Jews and he imprisoned them in his hippodrome. And he said to his people, "The moment I die, you go in there and you kill all the Jews." Why did he do that? Nobody would mourn his death, but they would mourn. Well, after he died, his instructions were not carried out. All the glories of his life, and there were many, were soon forgotten. Well, we are familiar with the Gospels that tell of the life of Christ. John the Baptist was the forerunner, and Jesus began preaching around 30 years after he and Jesus were born. In the Gospels, we learn about the religious climate of their day, but we learn very little about the political scene. Somebody tell me, what did Jesus say about Herod politically? He called him that fox. The Herod who reigned when Jesus was born died shortly after having all the boy babies massacred around Bethlehem. He divided the kingdom among three sons. For example, Joseph and Mary fled to Egypt after Jesus was born because his life was in danger. Matthew 2:19 through 23 says this. By the way, why don't you turn to that? Chapter 2, verse 19. But when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Arise and take the young child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the young child's life are dead." Then he arose, took the young child and his mother, and came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus, now here's one of the sons that the kingdom was divided into, was reigning over Judea instead of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Why? Because they knew who Archelaus was. And being warned by God in a dream, he turned aside into the region of Galilee. And he came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, "He shall be called a Nazarene." The book I have been quoting from says of Archelaus, "While he waited for the Roman emperor to give formal approval to his succession, the Jews broke out in revolt, infuriated by the last executions of Herod. Archelaus inaugurated his reign." By the way, Jesus is growing up at this time. This is what's happening. "Archelaus inaugurated his reign by massacring 3,000 people in the temple court, crowded with Passover pilgrims." Imagine, Christ is growing up at this time. He's a boy. The peoples were slaughtered like sheep, side by side with their temple offerings. Josephus writes, "And the temple was filled with their dead." And Jesus and John are now a few years old. So COVID is bad. Now think of that in light of the present universal upheaval caused by our pandemic. The instability and division caused by what is called this pandemic is universal. It's amazing. People hate one another in some places. Churches. We don't know what's going to happen to the church when they open the doors. So all of this is taking place at this time. If this book was written in AD 65, some of the Hebrew Christians to whom this book is written may have lived through this stuff. And they became Christians, rejected all of this, became Christians, and now are thinking of going back. The writer then says, no sooner was one rebellion crushed than another began, and the 10 years of Archelaus' reign were a long, bloody feud. Think of this. Every year, what did they think? Well, the Jews in Israel banded together and were able to get rid of Archelaus. The book I'm quoting from now writes of Felix, and you will have read of him in the book of Acts. Felix is mentioned in the book of Acts, and the book says, of Felix, risen from slavery, Tacitus writes, he exercised the prerogative of a king in the spirit of a slave, with superlative cruelty and licentiousness. He and several of his successors were merciless in the levying of taxes, and those who collected them were hated more than thieves. You remember, what was Matthew? What was he? Tax collector in this time. Now, Josephus said, the officials of the Roman provinces are like flies on a sore. But those already sated, satisfied with blood, do not do such so hard as the newcomers. The newcomers came along and killed even more. Later he writes of Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate, the procurator who sentenced Jesus to death, was such a governor. He ruled for 10 years until his recall, AD 36, quarreling almost continuously. What do you think New Year's was like there? So think of this now. During the time of Pontius Pilate, Jesus was crucified and the church was born. What time was it born into? There was almost continuous political quarreling. And the church was born into a politically poisonous atmosphere. The book says he smuggled soldiers into the holy city by night, bearing silver images of the emperor on their ensign. The Jews were so incensed that they besieged him for 5 days, and he gave in only when the whole nation was ready to rise up against him. Think of the history into which the church was born. If you lived in that day and you thought that Jesus is the Messiah and he's going to come back soon, and now things are just getting worse and worse and worse, soon you too might be like the Hebrews. I too might be like the Hebrews. What's the use of this new religion? The Messiah not coming back. There's no use in this. Look at my Jewish friends. They got all this stability. I'm being chased around. Here's a word from history for us. Do not despair. Yes, you can trust in the return of Christ. If there are 200 more years and 30 more pandemics, you can still trust in Christ. But then realize that in our time, there may be one such thing as COVID after another. We may face it. We need to be ready for that. Learn to trust and rejoice regardless of the political events around us. Think big. Think long. Do not get discouraged because of what you see all around us. Do you remember Peter? Well, let me read him for you. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So he said, come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? Why do we doubt? May I ask you, in this time we are in, do you rest in the Lord? Do you get all uptight with others because of the divisions? You know what I've found in myself? I have to watch what I say. I get caught up in stuff I don't want to be caught up in. Now, I do not know when the Jewish people to whom the book of the Hebrews became Christians, but many of them likely lived through much, if not all, of what we've been talking about here. You see, from the time the church was born until this book was written is maybe 30 to 40 years. And maybe in hopes of Jesus as the Messiah and his soon return, they gladly took up this new hope. And then one disastrous event after another took place. Surely they had heard that Jesus was returning soon, and yet more trouble. If these are Jews who have been driven out of Spain, maybe their families are scattered in various countries. Let me quote from the book again. Under all the procurators, good and bad alike, there were clashes and the land seethed with rebellion. The most serious opposition came from Galilee, where the Zealots became the leaders. They were extremists and shrank from nothing to bring down their heathen masters. Their watchword was, no God but Yahweh, no tax but to the temple, no friend but the zealot. The crucifixion, which foiled every unsuccessful flouting of imperial power, only had the effect to arousing avengers, who fought on until they too hung in agony on a public gibbet. One person after another hanging on crosses over the land. Now it is possible that the cry of the zealots affected the Hebrews to whom this book is written. There were four branches of Jews. Can anybody name some of them? You're familiar with some of them. The New Testament talks lots about them. Sadducees, Pharisees. They're mentioned the most, so we know those. And then there were the zealots and the Essenes. Now, place yourself in that time. You have become a Christian. Christ, so you have been taught, is the Messiah. He had been resurrected from the dead, and he had gone to heaven. And his half-brother, James, is pastor in Jerusalem. He was James the Just. Surely he knew the truth. But nothing is going right, and the horizon is covered with dark clouds. Our own present situation is not as bad yet as it was. Why are we so easily discouraged? Or are we? I quote from the book again. Ultimately, Roman patience was thoroughly exhausted, and the procurators introduced measures of barbarous severity. Soldiers slew on the slightest provocation. So we complain when we put our mask on somewhere. We could lose our life there. Eminent Jewish leaders were crucified. Whole villages were razed. All in vain. A fever of martyrdom seemed to seize upon the harassed people. Fanatics went up and down the country, wild-eyed and frantic, prophesying the end of the world and the advent of the Messiah. Multitudes were ready to follow every impossible visionary who claimed inspirations from heaven. Zealots rushed to their deaths, crying out in hysterical exultation. What was one to do? This is Rome talking now. What was one to do with such a nation? The Romans were frankly bewildered. They had dealt with many turbulent peoples, but with none so contrary, so insanely intractable as the Jews. We begin to get the picture why the Hebrews of our letter were getting discouraged. So let's say you have dropped Judaism, you have become a Christian. Maybe like these Hebrews, you have suffered persecution. People have said bad things about you. Your own Jewish people have rejected you. And the Messiah you thought would be coming, not coming. You don't even hear anything about him anymore, just what people tell you. There are a few letters floating around in the churches. No New Testament, by the way. No New Testament. Some letters floating around, but nobody knows which one is right, which one isn't. Should you believe these letters? Or should you go back to the Bible you're used to. Maybe go back to the synagogue. That would be much easier. So these were the things that they had to think about. And the Hebrews he's writing to, they're saying, I think we're going back. It is evident from the first two chapters in Hebrews that somehow angels became a big topic to these Jewish believers. It sounds as if they were switching their hope from trusting in Christ to being delivered by angels into the kingdom to come. The writer Randall C. Gleason, in a section titled Angels and the Eschatology of Hebrews 1 and 2, says, however, even if the recipients, that is, those to whom the letter was written, Hebrews, lived outside the Jewish homeland, the question of Jerusalem's future would be a vital concern for the Jews of the diaspora, since they continued to see the Jewish capital as their center of worship. Furthermore, the devastating consequences of the war with Rome were not limited to Palestine or Israel. Josephus records how the wrath of Rome fell on many Jewish communities of the diaspora. The hostilities against Jews that began at Caesarea quickly spread to the cities of Syria. In Alexandria, Roman legions were permitted not only to plunder and burn Jewish homes, but also to kill thousands of Jewish inhabitants. Following the war, the Jews of Antioch continued to suffer Roman reprisals under Titus. Hence, regardless of their location, the exhortation to seek the heavenly city, which is what the book of Hebrews talks about, rather than the earthly Jerusalem, would have been meaningful to the Jewish people. The church this letter is written to is largely Jewish, and with all that is happening, they are discouraged. So think of that in the new year. Those times will come for you. Discouragement. They had their hopes raised that Jesus was the Messiah, but no one has heard from him since he left, and everything is upside down in Israel, their home nation. And so, what are these Jewish believers to make of the one they had thought was the Messiah? Is he really coming? And then a teaching comes along, and it is growing in numbers. There's hope of deliverance for the Jews from angels. Maybe the angels. That's angels instead of Messiah. This is Hebrews chapters 1 and 2. Let me quote from an article, Angels and the National Deliverance. It says, a nationalistic eschatology rooted in Old Testament promises of divine deliverance flourished among the various groups within the Second Temple Judaism. Let me just mention, Second Temple Judaism is from 515 BC to 70 AD. At the writing of Hebrews, 70 AD was not far away, or as the time of writing. I continue the quote. Now, this common hope fueled the rise of nationalism, leading to the first Jewish revolt in AD 66 to 70, and those who are familiar with Masada, that it fell shortly thereafter. Christopher Rowland explains one factor which played a part in the disastrous events of that time was the desperate conviction that God was going to intervene on the side of his people and destroy those who were so sorely besetting them. The prominent role of angels in Israel's deliverance is evident in much of the Jewish literature circulating in Palestine by the first century. The clearest example is the war scroll found at Qumran. This remarkable text provides a vivid example of the apocalyptic worldview commonly found within contemporary Judaism. It foretells a great eschatological war consisting of seven battles between the sons of light, that is the members of this community, and the sons of darkness, and that is Rome. And the sons of darkness, that is the Romans, or Kittim, and wicked Israelites. God eventually triumphs over Belial, that's Satan, and all his angels by destroying all the men of his forces forever. The elaborate descriptions of this bloody conflict frequently mention the presence of holy angels fighting alongside the sons of light. In the final battle, God sends help through Michael, the archangel, who leads them and their angelic escorts to a decisive victory and another or another Qumran text records Michael encouraging the angels with a report of an elite angelic force defending Mount Zion, declaring, I found their fiery troops. So they're starting. You can't read Hebrews 1 and 2 and understand it unless you understand this. This is the background to this. I quote again, as the reward for his victory, God promises to exalt the authority of Michael among the gods. This ensures Michael a prominent role among the angelic hosts in the world to come. The world to come, there's the millennial age. The songs of the Sabbath sacrifice found at both Qumran and Masada echo the same theme of angelic troops led by their warrior God in armed conflict against his enemies as they march out from their military-style camps into battle. These angelic armies offer continuous worship to God, exalting him for his warrior acts. So you hear, things are really bad. Now there is hope. Maybe the angels. Michael, yeah, well, Michael, he helped back there in the Old Testament. Maybe Michael is going to deliver us out of this. The theme of angels waging war against the enemies of Israel is also prominent within the apocalyptic literature of the same period. The Book of the Watchers, in the Book of Enoch, begins by announcing that God is coming with 10 million holy ones. Does this sound familiar to anyone? What are you laughing about? What is it? The Book of Jude quotes the same writer. Later, Suriel, Raphael, these are angels, Raquel, Michael, Sarakul, and Gabriel are introduced as the angels who stand watch over God's people and lead these holy ones coming to destroy the enemies of God. The similitude of 1st Enoch likewise predicts that in the last days God will send out the angels of plague with chains to execute judgment upon the kings and the potentates of the earth. These angels will usher in a time of peace with the righteous of Israel and shall have rest from the oppression of sinners. So here's hope now. Here's hope of deliverance. Go, my time is almost gone. Go to chapter 2 for one moment. It seems that some hope of deliverance by angels has crept into their thinking, the thinking of these discouraged Christians. And in the rest of the book, it seems they are contemplating going back to Judaism. They have gotten saved, but now with all that is happening, it seems the Messiah they had come to trust in is doing nothing for them. Discouragement has set in, and they are thinking of returning to Judaism. In studying Hebrews, it seems to me that the writer is addressing two problems. One is that of the readers are falling into, that is, the teaching of angels. This is dealt with in chapters 1 through 2. The second problem is that they appear to be considering leaving the Christian faith and going back to Judaism. And so look at chapter 2, verse 5. For he, God, has not put the world to come. What is that? That's the kingdom we're expecting. Has not put the world to come of which we speak in subjection to angels. Though he's warning them, where you are going, this is not what the Bible teaches. They're warning them in that. So it appears that the teaching that they have been considering to follow says that the coming kingdom will be run by angels or ushered in by angels. But the writer to the Hebrews says that God has not put the world to come in subjection to angels. This is a false hope. And when you read the rest of the letter, returning to Judaism is a false hope as well. So, politically, in conclusion, most of the years Christ lived on earth had all kinds of politics. Nothing was easy. After Christ ascended and went to heaven, there was all kinds of politics, all kinds of death. Nothing was easy. Were we anywhere promised to have an easy time of it? Anybody? Are we discouraged? Do we get down? Oh, I just can't wait till this thing is over. Well, that's true enough. But can we let that discourage us? We have to turn to the Lord and learn to trust him. You know what? It doesn't matter what age or stage of life you are. Trusting God is never easy for us as humans. Look at Mom and Dad here. Is it easy now? Mom, is life easy now? Life is never easy. I think in some ways it gets harder. Those of you who are a little older, is it easier now or harder than when you were younger? Well, what is it? It's harder. Can we learn to trust him? Do we expect that the days that are coming will get easier? This is what I would encourage us to prepare ourselves for. If we have some good time, that would be wonderful. But we probably sleep in if it does. But get ready for more. And you know what the book of Hebrews says? Lift up those, what? Feeble hands. Straighten out those crooked knees. What do we say, Daryl? Up and onward. Up and onward. Well, may the Lord encourage you. In the new year, you have new battles, so do I. Overcome.